From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week marks 1 year since Donald Trump was elected president, an election that laid wide open new divisions in American politics and put a new kind of president in the White House. In the wake of Trump's win, we vowed here at On Point to get out and listen, to hear what Americans were thinking about where we've come and why. We've been to Charlotte, Milwaukee, Detroit, Atlanta, Tampa, Spokane, Kent, Ohio, before all of those. We'll keep traveling and listening, but Ames, Iowa wraps up our special tour, and appropriately. After voting for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, Iowa went last November for Donald Trump. And Iowa is where the next presidential campaign will start to swirl. What are Iowans thinking about President Trump, about what we've learned in this year, what we've seen, and where we are headed? This hour On Point, we are in Iowa, and we are listening. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. A year after the 2016 election, where are we? Where do we need to be? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We are broadcasting today from the studios of WOI in Ames, Iowa, and we've got all kinds of Iowans with us to dig in. Let me introduce you to our panel here in the studio in Ames. Cheryl Johnson is here. She's a farmer from Cushing, Iowa, where she grows soybeans, alfalfa, corn, raises cattle. She's run that farm herself since her husband Dan died in 2013. She's 54. A mom, a grandmother, and a Republican. Cheryl Johnson, we're very glad to have you with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Jill Nicewander is with us, 37, Iowa native, began her career in corporate finance in Des Moines, then went nonprofit, was a founding partner of Dress for Success Des Moines, a mother of four, a Democrat, now works with a refugee assistance group called Embark. Jill, it is wonderful to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
John Shepler is here, 60, the owner of Orning Glass in Ames, Iowa. He's a native of Iowa, a conservative, was a Trump voter, a father of three, one of whom voted for Bernie Sanders. John Shepler, welcome back to On Point. We've talked before. It's great to have you with us here today.
You too, Tom. Thank you.
And Marlou Arbaca is here, 25, a Democrat, originally from Southern California. Marlou moved to Iowa in 2010 to attend Grinnell College, now a bilingual services assistant for the Des Moines Public Library, and works with Hola America Media. It's a news service for the Midwest Latino community. She was appointed by former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, now the U.S. Ambassador to China, to the Iowa Commission of Latino Affairs. Marlou, it's wonderful to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
So here we are. We've talked to so many people this year over and around this entire country. And people just wrestling with exactly where we are, with what the outcome of the election last year meant, with what the new kinds of messages we're hearing from President Trump mean. Cheryl Johnson, there you are. You voted for Donald Trump for the presidency. Here we are 1 year in from the election at this point. How do you feel about the presidency and the direction the country's taking?
That's a loaded question.
It's, well,
Tom.
It's a big one. It's a big one, but that's why we're here.
Well, I'm still happy with my vote. Mm-hmm. I'm voted for him because I thought we needed change. The politics that were in place, I didn't feel like were working for Americans. The fact that he was a businessman appealed to me, and I think most of the Republican voters are supporters of Donald Trump. So for me, it was a huge change.
And a change that you've so far welcomed. How about his – I mean, you saw him talk change on the campaign trail. He's been in office. How do you feel about it? Is he sad? Is the performance satisfying you?
The performance isn't just the president anymore. It's the Congress, too. I wish he would do some things differently, if we're going to be point blank about it.
Okay.
The whole fake news, fake media thing with that's going on in his tweets and twittering.
You mean talking about that or the way he's accusing the media being fake news or –
Just everything, yeah. Yes. I don't care for how he talks. I don't care for the lack of respect in our country
mm-hmm.
for people, for politicians, mm-hmm. no matter what side of the fence you're on.
Mm-hmm.
Where that comes from, this farm woman south of Cushing, Iowa, probably isn't in the center of all that to make that judgment call. But it bothers me that that's the direction that our country takes and is so negative.
But in spite of that, are you sticking with him on his agenda as you see it, as you understand it?
Yes.
And why?
Well, right now, you know, the farm bill, you know, we haven't got everything back yet on the farm bill for what affects me personally. You know, he hasn't taken up the stepped up basis, having just recently lost my husband. That was a huge thing. You know, if farmers would have lost the opportunity for stepped up basis in their taxes, that would have been a
This is when you go to the value of the farm and how that's calculated.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I didn't have to sell a farm to be able to keep some of the farm.
Yeah.
So as far as that goes, health care, my health care is horrible right now. I mean, I'm jumping to health care here.
That's all right. It's a big deal.
But my health care, it doubled last year, and it's doubling again this year. And I've got an appointment next week to go in and visit with my agent to see what we can do differently.
Is it Affordable Care Act, or is it a private plan, or where are you
Blue Cross Blue Shield is what I was on, and I've been dropped, and so now I have to look at doing something different. So my premium is going to be a little over $12,000 a year.
All in all, if you could speak to the president today as a Republican on the farm watching the performance of this last year, what would you say to Donald Trump today, a year in?
I would tell him that we need to reform the health care for us, for the farmers, and I imagine all small business owners. What he's done for taxes for the farmers, I guess I feel he's doing okay yet. The trade agreement, NAFTA, you know, that opens up a whole book.
That was good for Iowa farmers.
It was good. But then you go from the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, go to what we're doing with China. You know, we owe them, what, over $1 trillion?
Way over, I believe.
And we want to sell them more. For me, we want to sell them more commodities. If I owe you $1 trillion and I come to you, Tom, and I say, hey, Tom, I got a bunch of grain I want to sell you, you're going to say, no, you need to just give it to me. Well, we want to do business with them, but why are they going to come to us and do business when we owe them so much money?
So you're with him when he's tough on trade with China, but on NAFTA you're...
My point would be, let's get this debt figured out and let's take care of this debt so we can have the trade, you know, and...
You can't fix the debt to China without a whole lot of trade surpluses somewhere with them.
But it's all coming, you know, we're getting everything, and what are they getting? You know, what are we getting? Our exports and our imports, how are they, you know, kind of one-sided?
Well, it has been for a long time now. Jill, nice one to you watching all of this. Iowa went for Barack Obama in 2008. They went for Barack Obama in 2012. Last time out, there it was, for Donald Trump. It was a very stark turn. How do you understand that as a Democrat watching this? How do you understand the change in the state where you're an Iowa native that has taken place? And it, of course, is not just at the presidential level. You see it right through the Iowa state legislature. This state has become a lot more red. How do you understand and interpret that, Jill?
Well, honestly, Tom, I don't understand a lot of it. I have been doing a lot of work to do that. I've been doing a lot of reading and exposing myself to different groups of people, because what I don't want to do is isolate myself as a voter and think that if I surround myself with everyone who agrees with me, then all of my answers are right. I believe one of the hardest things about politics right now is that there is no safe place for moderation. And I see that in our state legislature, and I see that at the federal level as well. There isn't room for someone to come out and say, hey, wait a second, there's actually an alternative. So the extreme nature of our political environment right now is a struggle for me. Throughout the entire year, I have struggled with the anthem that change was needed, and that's why Trump was elected, because 90% of incumbents in Congress were reelected. That doesn't sound like change to me. So that's a struggle for me. I think one of the things that has been a positive for the last year, which I didn't anticipate there being much of any, is that I see a community who realizes that if they want what they want, they have to do something about it. And so in the work that I do, I see more volunteers than ever. I see more people empowered to participate in our democracy and our systems and really understand their role in dictating how our country works.
When you say a community, do you mean Iowa? Do you mean Democrats? Do you mean immigrants? You work with refugees now, some? What community? Which community? All?
I do. I think all. We have more volunteers than we've ever had, sometimes more than we know what to do with, which is a great problem to have. And they come from all walks of life. They come from our older community who understand Iowa's legacy of refugee resettlement. They come from our young people who want to have more of a voice.
And you feel that there's just a sense of urgency that if you care about the country, you've got to be involved now? Is that it?
I do feel like that has been a shift, where I think a lot of people felt like, you know, somebody else will take care of it, or I don't need to work on that. And now there's this engagement that I didn't see before. And I think that's a positive.
John Scheffler, conservative. I'm not sure Trump was your first choice, but you ended up there. How do you feel about the country a year after President Trump's election?
This is difficult because it's you have to sum it up so quickly.
Well, any way you like it.
Well, I liked what both Jill and Cheryl are saying. You know, people need to be more engaged. What we need to be is more willing to talk to each other, to have a discussion, to have a debate, to open these ideas. This partisan on the right, partisan on the left is just going to lead us further and further down a hole that we seem intent on digging for ourselves. But what we really need to do is we need to find that center again, that respect for others, treating others with dignity. I don't like Trump's tone. I just don't like the way he talks. And there's a lot of labels that go out on Trump, but I think the one that fits the most is he's a narcissist. He's about himself. And so all of his statements sort of come off that way. He was not my first choice. I never tell people I voted for Trump. I always tell people that I didn't vote for Hillary. And, you know, that's just how I feel about it because he really wasn't my choice. I believe, though, that we owe it to him to respect the office, to respect the fact that he's our leader. We've been told throughout history that even the most despot of tyrants, if they're the leader, we need to respect them, that they are our leader.
Even the most despotic of tyrants?
A Nebuchadnezzar or someone like that, we have to recognize the office, and then we have to take action from there when there's an unjust law or there's an unjust situation. But we can't just rail against the government. That's non-productive.
I get that. A despotic tyrant, I don't know. We'll see where that label falls. Marlou, well, the clock is biting me here, but I'll come right to you after a short break. We are wrapping up our year-long national listening tour today in Ames, Iowa. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point from Ames, Iowa. We'll be right back.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are wrapping up our year-long national listening tour today in Iowa, Ames, Iowa, home to Iowa State, surrounded by a whole lot of corn and beans, pretty much right in the middle of Iowa, and thinking with Iowans today about where this country stands, where it's headed. Right now, you can join us today. What are you thinking this week, 1 year after the election of Donald Trump, about where we're headed? How did we get here to the politics we have now, to this president we have now, and where do we need to be going? What's your question for our Iowans about how their state turned, about what they're thinking, hoping, fearing? Does it just get crazier, or do we somehow get back on the same page across political lines in this country? Cheryl Johnson is with us. Jill Nicewander is here. John Scheffler. Marlou Arbaca is here, 25 years old. Came from California to Grinnell College in 2010. Has stayed and is part, well, I don't know if we can say part of, but certainly the Latino community in Iowa has grown a lot in recent years. Marlou, your thoughts over the last year as you've been here in Iowa watching the tone of our politics change, maybe the tone of our culture change in some ways. What have you observed in Iowa?
Hi. So I think this all started during the pre-caucus era in Iowa. The first time that I had heard Trump talk about Mexicans, which I'm of Mexican heritage, it was very difficult. And so
he was talking about criminals and rapists.
Yes. So hearing a candidate speaking that way about a group of people that, I mean, it statistically doesn't hold any ground, but also hearing that throughout the campaign trail and then eventually becoming president of the United States has been very difficult to swallow.
Has it made your day-to-day life different? Has it made it more difficult?
Yes. Since November 9th, 2016, I've felt very insecure in my community. I've been in Iowa for almost a decade, and it's always been a welcoming place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're all familiar with the Iowa Nice, people, but just feeling afraid that I would be judged or challenged on me speaking Spanish in public, for example, or where people, I think, might have already held certain biases against me for being a person of color, people then feeling emboldened to make racist comments out in public.
You're on, among many other things, you're on the governor-appointed Iowa Commissioner of Latino Affairs. Can you describe the Latino population in Iowa now and the importance to this state, its economy?
Sure. There's close to 180,000 Latinos in the state. In Des Moines alone, the population is growing significantly, and Latino students make up about 25% of that school district here in the capital.
Very important in the ag industry, working on hog farms and dairy farms and meat packing plants and more.
Iowa has a legacy of granting visas for ag workers, and many of those are from Latin American countries.
And within that community, does it feel like a year in which people, is it just you, or do people feel less, viscerally less welcome?
Yes, and we've seen an increase in the incidence of bullying in schools across Iowa, where they're very racially motivated in their bullying.
Cheryl, what are you feeling as you hear that about this population within your state?
Well, I feel terrible for it, and that really shouldn't. The bullying is an issue for whatever race or ethnicity you are. But I have employed ag workers who are here, or that have legally, or that have documentation, or that have come by coyote. Mm-hmm. They know that they're here illegal, and they run. You know, they do. They're aware of that. Do I, you know, and I don't think Trump has a problem with people coming here, as long as they come the right way, correct? Or, you know, I'm not an expert on that issue, but I would say, you know, no different than my grandparents and my great grandparents came, you know, they came the right way. They didn't come by coyote. And I'm not, you know, I don't want to be evil about it. I don't want to be disrespectful about it. But the fact that they're getting bullying, is that an issue of what John said about, is that because we have such a lack of respect for our politics and the name calling and the, you know, that's just not right. That's just
general
evil.
Coarsening.
Yeah.
But there's a racial element here as well. Is Iowa at grips with that? Jill, you work in this field. What do you say?
I would say yes. I think that there has been a large influx of fear across communities, and it isn't unique to the Latino community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really unfortunate. And I think this tone and the disrespect, that's part and parcel with who we elected as a country. And I think even if that wasn't your intent, that is your impact. And that's really unfortunate.
Marlou, I mean, you have said, I think, that you came out of the L.A. area to Iowa. You chose, I mean, you chose to come here. You chose to stay here. You've made a home here. But if I've got it right, sometimes you think, well, I could go back to a part of the country where I wouldn't face, where Latinos are more populous and more common, and where I wouldn't feel this, what I guess is a new level of discomfort that's hit you in Iowa.
Yes. And I mean, I think about that. I have family in Los Angeles, and if I wanted to be in a place where I was the majority again and where I didn't feel in fear embracing my roots or my culture, on a daily basis, I could return, but it's also my privilege to be able to do that. And I'm a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. I have many of the privileges that many other Latinos don't have, and many people in Iowa don't have. And I feel like it's my duty, my responsibility to make this a safe place and not just leave it for my own comfort.
John, what do you think when you hear Marlou describe that fear on a daily basis being a Latina now here?
That's hard for me to answer because obviously, I'm not part of that community. I think it's wrong, but I do believe that it has to do, and it's not just since Trump has been in office. It's been going on for a couple of decades. We've coarsened ourselves. We've conditioned ourselves to not care about the other people. It's all about my life, how I feel, what I want to do, and we don't really stop and have respect for other people. I think there's a larger issue, and again, I think both our political parties have absolutely failed us as a people. They do not work for us anymore. And so,
who do they work for then? I mean, they're over there doing something.
They work for their pocketbook. They work for the people that basically fund their campaigns and fund their lifestyles. And there's, I'm not into conspiracy theories, don't get me wrong, but they don't work for us. They don't work together from both sides of the aisle and ask a simple question before they do anything. What is best for the American people?
You looking at the country through that lens, you ended up voting for Donald Trump. Within your family, you had Bernie Sanders support, right? Mm-hmm. Right within your own, you got kids and right within your own kids. What about that answer to, they looked out on that same American situation and at least one of them said, Sanders is my guy.
Everybody goes through an evolution in their thought processes and the way they look at the world. When you're young, you're very idealistic in a lot of situations and you think that there's answers from the government when in truth, the government should only play a certain role in your life and there should be other things that play equal or even more important roles in your life. The simple, quick answer is always, give me more, I'll be happier, I'll be content. But the truth is that the more you give people, the less content they are, the less willing they are to fend for themselves and do the things that need to be done. And the things that through work and through participation that really feed the person, that gives them a sense of worth. The more you give people, the less they have. Bernie, he uses the word, so I feel I can use the word. I mean, it's socialism. It's hey, trust me.
He uses it proudly, democratic socialism, yeah. As in let's take care of, let's make sure everybody gets the basics covered.
Charles Colson wrote a book back in the 80s about socialism and its march through the world over the last 120 years. And in every single case, it fails. And in every single case, someone else rises up and says, well, you know, it failed over there, but we'll make it work here. We've got better answers. And the truth is, there are no better answers. It leads to the same thing. Look at Venezuela. I'm a big fan of anybody who wants to support that. We should buy them a ticket, take them to Venezuela, say, we're going to pick you up in 3 months, and then see how you feel about it.
Jill, is that our problem? We take too much care of people in this country?
I would have to wholeheartedly disagree with that. I think that there is a large issue of distinguishing between having people have opportunities to be stabilized and create opportunities for them to move themselves forward and handouts. I think one of the things that I've seen pervasively over the last year is a highlight of our innate human desire to hierarchy people. And what I think that the Trump campaign did was give a lot of people who felt like they were on the bottom more people to put underneath them. And that makes them feel stronger for whatever reason. I think that there are ways that you can help people that give them dignity and give them the opportunity to move in the direction that people think that they should move. And there are ways that are systemically holding them back that are not being addressed.
We've been all over this country in this year talking with people in many parts of the United States about what's happening, and we have heard so many levels of concern, hope, fear, everywhere, a sense that we're in a new political time now here in this last year with ramifications both for our culture, a kind of maybe the climax of a certain kind of politics, though we don't know, it could go further still. Economic implications as well. I want to look at those. We are in Ames, Iowa, the last stop on our national listening tour with four terrific Iowans. And we've got callers from all over the place, including a lot from right here in Iowa. Josh from Belmond, Iowa. Josh, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am a farmer as well, similar to Cheryl. But mm-hmm. I have an entirely different view of our president because I feel like listening to his promises that he made on the campaign and now looking at what he's done in office, he's betrayed every promise that he made to Iowans. You know, we're struggling in my family. We're struggling to get health care. And it's not necessarily because Obamacare imploded, but because he's sabotaged it. We've got an EPA director who's trying to get rid of the renewable fuel standard to help out his cronies in the oil industry. I'm surrounded right now in the tractor in a field of corn that's designated for an ethanol plant. You know, and if we didn't have that ethanol mandate, we'd be going back to poverty wages that I grew up with in the 80s. And I do feel I have to echo some of the other guests' concerns about this hatred that's been unleashed, because my son's best friend is a Latino. His mother is a refugee from El Salvador. Mm-hmm. And during the election, a family member of mine came up to Will and berated him for hanging out with that damn Mexican and just went off on him. And Will and I didn't say anything. We were stunned. We had no idea what to say, that a almost 40-year-old man was yelling at a 10-year-old boy for being friends with another 10-year-old boy, regardless of wherever he's from. And so I'm just scared. I've got a 1-year-old daughter at home, and I'm just worried what this president is going to leave for her when she's old enough to take the reins and make decisions. Is it going to be a shell of what I grew up with here in rural America, or is it going to be a better place? And I'm hoping that people step up and counter what I've seen unleashed in the last year.
Josh, I appreciate your call. Marlou Abarca, when you hear Josh's concern, his son's best friend, I mean, it's terrible to hear his son being berated. You know, what are you doing with that Mexican? On the other hand, here's Josh, who's resisting this, who doesn't want to see this. What does it leave you feeling as a Latina here in Ames?
Sure. I mean, that incident alone tells me that it's not about whether your documents are undocumented, because apparently the boy's family was here through the visa that was granted for Salvadoran refugees during the 80s in Iowa. To them, any person that's brown is Mexican, and it further perpetuates the racism that was introduced, or at least highlighted, during the Republican campaign.
Cheryl, you've got, there are a lot of interests here. One is, we need to live together. We need to work together as a country. We need a good economy. We need good trade. What's the balance for you at this point? You can hear the visceral fear and concerns that we've had expressed here. We've got Josh calling in, another farmer, about them. On the other side, and he's not confident on the economic front in the administration to this point. Do you share those fears?
Well, certainly, but those economic issues did not just happen in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
They've been coming for decades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was it, Reagan that announced, you know, when we first were in debt so much, and I was like, holy smokes, that's been a lot of presidents ago.
Yes, it is.
The issue of how people treat each other, heavens, yes. You know, the other side, that's pure evil. People not being considerate to, I don't care what color your skin is, that's just wrong.
Do you think the president has encouraged that with his comments, his statements, his demeanor?
Could he use his words a little wiser? Yes, he could. I don't think he is. I don't believe he's intentionally hurting anybody. I mean, I don't think he means that. I don't want to believe anybody intentionally does that. But again, it's his lack of respect for the American word. You know, we're talking about the respect of office. We're talking about the respect of people. You know, he could choose more wisely. Could he be positive? Yes. But, you know, the day he was sworn in and the negativity that was shown and the lack of respect for what was happening that day by whomever they were, that was, to me, that was a huge downfall. I mean, that was, it started there. It started there with, you know, all the protests and all the feminism. And I am in a man, I live in a, work in a man's world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've lost that respect for, and just treating people with genuine kindness. And when
does
stuff like
President
that,
Trump
and when it
represent
starts,
that?
And that, when that starts, but who didn't show up for his inauguration that day?
Well, were they obligated to come out? Maybe they.
I think that if you're in Congress, you should show up just out of respect for, you know, just respect for the office and what our country stands for, you know. And that when they didn't show up, it just started downhill, and it just started, and I hate the word, but fake media. What is right? What's wrong? You know, what is being said in the media is right? I don't know. It gets really, you get torn. And if I could address the farmer in Belmont's, you
yes.
know, we just had our governor and senators go to EPA and the Renewable Fuel Standards Act went to bat for us. You know, I have friends that are in the oil industry. You know, they're facing tough times. I raise corn in Iowa that's used in ethanol plants, you know, for a lot of byproducts. You know, I think we are addressing those issues as they come about. You know, I don't think it's all been perfect, but not even a year into it since he's been in office. So
patience and readiness to be patient there on the part of Cheryl Johnson, a farmer here in Iowa. Jill Nicewander, please stand by. John Shepler owns a commercial contract glazing glass company here in Ames, Iowa. Marlou Abarca is with us. Watching all of this, you can join us as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are wrapping up our year-long national listening tour today in Iowa, Ames, Iowa. We have been all over this country in the last year talking with Americans about how they see what's unfolding in our culture, our politics, and today we're sitting down with four Iowans. Marlou Abarca is with us here in Ames. John Shepler is here, Jill Nicewander, and Cheryl Johnson. Cheryl, a 54-year-old farmer from not so far from here, Cushing, Iowa. You can join us as well. What do you see unfolding in this year since the election of President Trump? What are your hopes, your fears, your vision of what's coming, what could be, how we make this country its best, where we're going right now? And what's your question for Iowa? Brooke in St. Petersburg, Florida, you're joining the panel in Iowa. Brooke, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Mm-hmm. First, I just wanted to say I'm really impressed with the guests that you have on today. I think that they all have added something to the conversation, and I just want to just say amen to people need to talk more. There's definitely room for rationality and agreement in the middle.
Amen. And I'll say as well.
Also, yeah, I'm tired of the partisanship. Nothing's going to get done that way. I voted for Nader. I voted for Obama, and I voted for Trump. I'm tired of a two-party system. I'm tired of the establishment. I'm tired of Washington being awash in foreign money and influence and lobbying. And I still have some hope that things can change, and that's why I voted for Trump. I do agree with some of his policies. I moved here. I wanted my vote to count, first of all, and to see if it did count. And I feel like that's one thing that came out of the election. I don't feel like the establishment on either side, the RNC or the DNC, wanted Donald Trump in there. Of course, the DNC didn't, but that was encouraging to me that that's possible. And I also moved from Southern California 5 years ago to Florida, and I was a court-appointed special advocate for 8 years. And I dealt with, I had three case children. And my third one, I just saw how the bureaucracy and the corruption in the state government in California, the more money you gave them, the more corrupt it got, the less connected that the money was to the policies and that we were connected to the money that we were forking over.
Are you getting what you hoped for a year in, Brooke? Are you getting what you hoped for with your Trump vote?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I think that progress is going to be made with China, which is really important. If we can get tax reform done, that would be great. But I think there's just a lot of people have their own interests at heart, their own reelection, trying to look good before what they think their constituents are. And, my mom has a saying, Republicans eat their own. And I think that's kind of true. However, I also think it's healthy because people are trying to represent the districts that they're from. But if they could find agreement and pass those legislation items first, I think the whole administration would flow better. And I think that's kind of the problem.
Brooke, we've got it. I appreciate your call from St. Petersburg, Brooke. And I want to bring it to our Iowa panel here, if I may. And I thank you very much for it. I mean, John, you're listening there. And I know you've been watching closely. I know it was a reluctant vote in some ways, and it's been such a year of high drama, just on and on, one thing after another. You've said that sometimes you look out at what's going on and see a kind of a ball of yarn theory unfolding here. What do you mean by that?
There's so much entanglement. You talk about all of the different special interests. You talk about just all of the different areas of government and life in general. And the problem is we talk about these issues in the abstract and we talk about them in large things, when in reality, they're all intertwined. And as soon as you start pulling out one thread and say, well, this would be a solution to this problem, unfortunately, it's going to unravel other problems and you have to deal with
that. Is that unfortunate or fortunate? I mean, are you worried about our political culture, our culture unraveling, or are you talking about draining the swamp?
I'll tell you what I'm talking about. And nationally, there's not a lot I can do about that. My wife has also been a CASA advocate, and Brooke, thank you for doing that, because these children need someone who can step into their lives and show them. Brooke is stepping in, my wife steps in, I step in with one person, and if I can make a difference in that one person's life, then I trust that they'll make a difference in somebody else's life. I treat them with respect, I treat them with dignity, and basically we are able to talk about things. The problem is we get to a point where we get so blinded in our worldview that we can't talk anymore. So I think Cheryl maybe said, we don't talk to each other anymore. We don't look for solutions. We are all standing on our pillars, screaming about the one thing that's important to us or the one thing that we're against. We need to start looking at things from a perspective of, what can I do in my life to make somebody else's life better? And then if enough people do that, that will become a groundswell, and then we can make changes. But if we wait for the top,
yep.
if we keep pointing at Trump or yep. Obama yep. or anybody else,
yep.
we're just going to sit here 10 years from now and have this exact same conversation.
Jill, you've talked about people being more engaged in the last year, but do you feel that reach out and work together thing going on here in the new red Iowa? Is that what's happening?
I can't say that I feel like that's what's happening. I think that people are committing to those things that are important to them and realizing that action is necessary if they want to move those agendas forward. And I think one of the things that we struggle with is how we talk about what's important to us and the impact and how you can frame your argument, if that's what you want to call it, or your opinion, and make it so that somebody else can actually absorb that information instead of automatically being on the defensive. And narrative is important. I think changing the narrative in this country matters. I think remaining hopeful is the number one thing that we can do. There are a lot of hard days. There are a lot of days where I have struggled to get myself into the office and face the community members that I have to face every day with what's going on.
But I mean, this week with the Sutherland Springs shooting has been a hard week for me. I don't know about the rest of you, but I've just found that just a very, very heavy weight to carry this week, the sorrow for that community and the country.
Right. And I agree with John, actually. I appreciate a lot of his comments today in the fact that, if we can talk about what we're for and why we're for it, that's so much more productive than only hearing what you're against. And if the first thing out of your mouth is an accusation, that doesn't get us anywhere at a table where we can make decisions and actually move forward. So keeping hope, changing this narrative are two things that I focus on almost a daily basis. And in the problems that I see, not only am I asking myself, how can I be a solution or how can my volunteers be a solution, but how can I stop participating in what the issues are and what the systemic issues are that my country has.
They are aplenty. Kurt in Ames, Iowa, right here where we're broadcasting today. Kurt, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have many problems with Trump, but the two biggest are global. Number one, he has denigrated the global order that's been set up that was initiated by Roosevelt and Churchill to make sure that there isn't another World War II, and they, out of that came Bretton Woods, out of that came NATO, out of that came the UN, and yep. Trump has denigrated both the UN and NATO. So, and the U.S. has been the leader in this global order. This global order, since communism fell in 91, has cut global poverty in half, and it hasn't kept the peace totally. Obviously, we've had wars since then, but
yes.
there's been no world war. So it's been a very successful global order. Trump's moved out of that order, denigrates it, and so Xi Jinping has moved in with his statement at Davos that China plans on being a leader.
And what do you worry about there, Kurt, if you do? What do you worry about in that, if you do?
That we forfeit U.S. leadership and we give it over to a communist dictator, and I think that's bad globally because the U.S. has been a positive force in general, not always, but most of the time.
Yeah,
and I don't think Xi Jinping is going to be that positive force. But the second thing is also important and has to do with China. China now is spending tens of billions of dollars on microchips, artificial intelligence, electric cars. We're going to lose our technological leadership to China if we don't do something. Within 20 years, they'll be the technological leader of the world. And again, a communist dictatorship instead of a democracy will have that privilege. And Trump is too ignorant to do anything about it, like R&D, for example, research and development, which needs to be done.
Kurt, I appreciate your call. Marlou, as you listen to that, we've been talking about racial issues with you here in this country, but what about the U.S. place in the world, in the sense of the country having been at the center of a global order that it fairly well established, and this president saying no to that? That hasn't worked by his lights and clearly going another way. Kurt worries that it ultimately means China is number one, and they have a very different political values.
I think that as Americans, we value being number one in many arenas globally. There are so many problems and issues that we have domestically that we need to address before we can think about our place in the world. How many Americans are incarcerated? We're number one in the country in terms of proportionality for our population that is incarcerated. I worry about opportunity. You know, what systems do we have here that don't allow Americans to move forward and that harm our economy, both domestically and also our place in the economy globally?
I mean, how this works out over time, we know what's happening with our demographics. We can't stay at sword points ethnically or racially, given the changes that are happening in our country and happening right now. Jim in Spencer, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I wanted to speak to one point in particular about respect on Inauguration Day, for example. But I think that, you know, the number of hate crimes that were committed in Mr. Trump's name around the election, you know, the way that he was giving permission for, you know, people at his rallies to take action against any kind of protest. And I think that, you know, the church burnings of minority churches, these things were done in his name, and he was calling the people that voted for Hillary losers. I think if you really want respect from, you know, anybody, you have to recognize that, you know, the white supremacist that murdered this woman with his truck and these things, these cannot be sanctioned and ignored. He didn't speak at all about the kind of hate crimes that were taking place around the election. And even when, you know, this incident occurred that I just described, he compared it to, you know, tit for tat. And that's just not respect at all.
So respect needs to work both ways, I guess, the point here, Cheryl.
Correct. But I'm going to turn this topic
okay. Yeah.
We talk about all of these issues, and we talk about China, and we talk about everything. And doesn't it all come down to money?
And what do you mean?
Well, we need money for all these programs. We need money to pay our debts. We need money. If everybody had all the money they needed, wouldn't this be a happy world? Wouldn't we be getting along fine and dandy? But when we are in such debt, that is my biggest concern here, is the debt that this country has. And everybody wants to talk about being number one in research and development, or they want to be number one in, you know, we're at a deficit right now, aren't we, for exporting? I mean, we're at a deficit. So when are we going to take that back, and what are we going to do to fix that problem?
What do you feel about the tax plan that's on Capitol Hill right now? They're talking about that adding very substantially to our fiscal deficit here at home. Are you confident that it will change what you're worried about?
I can't probably speak to that right now.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in the field a lot lately.
Okay, bringing in the crop.
But I mean, that is the issue to me that is so important. And when you look at that debt calculator and it keeps ticking up, am I the only one that bothers? I mean, we need to figure. I guess I hoped in supporting and voting for Trump, he would be a businessman and he would treat this like a business. And I know government's, you know, it is a big business, but I was hoping that he would find a way and a plan, you know, and maybe I overlooked some of his sarcastic remarks and shouldn't have, you know, but to me that is what is so important.
Sarcastic, kind of a mild description of some remarks, a pretty mild white there. Let's go to Jim in Omaha, Nebraska.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Jim.
Let's say the tax plan went through and it put, let's say, $500 to $1,000 into the pocket of every middle-class Iowan at the expense of the deficit. Would that really change their lives?
John, what do you say?
Probably not. Again, if it's partisan, which this is going to be, it is not a solution for all Americans, and that's the problem. It's partisan, and we've gone way, way back before until you can find a bill that's gone through Congress that has had partisan support that actually made a difference in people's lives or put this country on a course that it should be
on. Do you believe
on.
It'll really work for the middle class? A lot of people say it's heavily weighted actually toward those who have a lot, and we've seen a great concentration of wealth in this country.
Yeah, there's details coming out now that basically are starting to show that the middle class is, as typical, is going to take a brunt of this tax change. You're not addressing the big issues like bringing money back from offshore. I know you did a show a couple weeks ago about Apple and how much money they have. I mean, none of this tax, and this is a point that I agree with my son on, none of this tax reform is going to make a huge change in those kinds of things. It's not going to bring new investment in. It's just going to kind of move the chairs around on the Titanic, but it's not really going to change the course.
Let me ask each of you quickly, Marlou, your greatest hope, your greatest fear?
Greatest hope is that we keep empowering younger generations to get involved and to continue to make a difference. My greatest fear is that we will continue this pattern where we aren't spreading the metaphorical wealth of knowledge and of empowerment, and we continue to marginalize people.
Jill, greatest hope, greatest fear?
My greatest hope would be that we can remember in all of this that leading globally matters locally. And I think that extends through economics and social issues. And my greatest fear is that these next 4 years will continue on the trajectory that it's on now, and it will take generations for us to recover from it.
John, hope and fear.
Well, my greatest hope is that we refine our moral and our ethical compass, and my greatest fear is that we won't do that. I just have to tell you, I think we need to live our lives by Jimmy Buffett and say, breathe in, breathe out, and move on.
Cheryl, you get the last word. Hope and fear. 2017.
Hope that this country turns around, and fear that we lose our independence, our free thinking, our I guess our ability to be a standalone country. And maybe I'm really to one side with my views, but I'm pretty proud of America, and I hope we can work through all of these issues and work together.
We'll hope for that.
Yes.
Cheryl Johnson, farmer here in Iowa, out of Cushing, Iowa, thanks very much for being with us today. Jill Nicewander, wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much for coming in. John Shepler, great to have you. We'll see how your family works out, the Bernie and the Trump and all the rest. And Marlou Abarca, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for everyone who's participated this year and are listening to it right across this country. Listeners, thanks to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.